So 2 Kings chapter 3 is our passage this evening as we continue this series in this book. Now it's several weeks ago that we were in chapter 1 of 2 Kings, but there were two details mentioned so fleetingly in that chapter, one right at the beginning, the other right at the end, that I don't think I even mentioned them in my exposition. The detail at the end of chapter 1 is Jehoram's accession to Israel's throne after the death of King Ahaziah. The detail at the beginning of the chapter is Moab's rebellion against Israel. And neither of those developments had any bearing on chapter 1's main story. And so, as I say, we just passed over both of them that night. But here in chapter 3, however, they are hugely relevant. Actually, they're both more fully explained here. Stuff that was simply assumed in those fleeting references in chapter 1 is now stated. So with Jehoram, we were told at the end of chapter 1 that he became king because Ahaziah had no son. But we weren't told who Jehoram actually is, whether a relative or just a palace cleaner that they suddenly decided to promote or what. Now in chapter 3, we're told in verse 1 that he's the son of Ahab, and so presumably a brother of the heirless Ahaziah. With Moab, we weren't told in chapter 1 the context of this nation's rebellion against Israel. Now in chapter 3, we discover that Moab had been a vassal of Israel, a subject nation obliged to meet certain terms and conditions set by Israel. Verse 4 of our passage, now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he had to deliver to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. That's not commerce that verse is talking about. Moab wasn't exporting these goods to Israel in return for payment. These goods were a payment, a tax or a tribute which King Mesha had to cough up annually to his overlord, the king of Israel. So both those details from chapter 1 are more fully explained here, but also, as I say, they're now hugely relevant, crucial, in fact, to what is going on in chapter 3, because for one thing, a main character in this chapter is King Jehoram, and for another thing, the storyline in this chapter is Jehoram, along with a couple of cronies, attempting to deal with Moab's rebellion. And without further ado then, let's get into 2 Kings chapter 3. And there are three things I want us to notice. First of all, a sad pattern. A sad pattern. Now, there are various questions with which any interpretation of this passage has to grapple. Perhaps the main one is this. Does Elisha's prophecy come true? Does Elisha's prophecy come true? I said just now, this chapter is the story of King Jehoram and his cronies being Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and the unnamed king of Edom, attempting to deal with Moab's rebellion. To that end, the three men set out together, but before they reach Moab, they hit a rather serious problem. Verse 9, there was no water for the army or for the animals that followed them. Napoleon is famously supposed to have said that an army marches on its stomach. Troops need provisions, and certainly they need water. The kings are thus rocked by this crisis that they've hit, and it prompts in Jehoshaphat's mind the thought they require some prophetic inputs. Is there no prophet of the Lord here? He asks in verse 11. Remarkably, there is a prophet of the Lord somewhere in the vicinity, Elisha, the man whom we met last time, 2 weeks ago. Elijah's successor as the main prophet in Israel, the possessor, you remember, of double the measure of the spirit which other prophets in Israel possess. He is nearby and therefore able to be visited. On visiting the man of God, the royal trio receive from him a prophecy. It's introduced by that iconic expression so beloved of biblical prophets, thus says the Lord. And it occupies four verses of our chapter, verses 16 to 19. They relay this prophecy from the lips of Elisha. And so back to our question then, does it come true? Certainly the first half of it does. Verses 16 and 17 foretell the provision of water for this parched army there in the wilderness, and unambiguously in verse 20, water comes. But what about the second half of Elisha's prophecy? It foretells the conquest of Moab. You can see immediately the pithy little statement in verse 18, he will also give the Moabites into your hand, which is then elaborated in verse 19. Does that come true? Do we see the fulfillment of this prophetic word? Does Israel conquer Moab? Well, the question, I think, is bound up with another to which we must now turn our attention, and it's this. When does the battle with Moab end? When does the battle with Moab end? Let's follow what happens from verse 23. The Moabites, who have heard about this military threat which they now face, they make a colossal misjudgment there in verse 23. They mistake water glowing red at sunrise for blood, the blood of the advancing coalition. Just two quick points there in defense of Moab. Number one, all this water that they see, it had, of course, materialized suddenly and abnormally in the sense that wildernesses don't usually contain much water, and abnormally in the sense that no rain had produced this water. We're told that in verse 17 by Elisha. So you wouldn't expect the Moabites to see something glowing red in the distance and conclude, oh, it's just water glowing red in the sunrise. Blood actually was a far more probable thing to be there in the wilderness than a whole stretch of water. And number two, these three rulers who had come against the Moabites, they were unlikely allies. Certainly the king of Edom is a strange participant in the whole thing, isn't he? Israel and Edom do not usually go to war on the same side as each other. They are ancient enemies. And the idea then that the coalition had broken down and had savagely turned in on itself, that's not actually such a ridiculous idea for the Moabites to entertain when they see this redness there in the distance. Anyway, the Moabites make their misjudgment and the Israelites take full advantage of it, and having dealt devastatingly with the Moabite army in verse 24, they then in verse 25 go through the land of Moab, asserting their dominance in precisely the terms Elisha had foretold. They overthrew the cities, and on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. They stopped every spring of water and felled all the good trees. Now, what happens next? The sequence of events we've just traced there in verses 23 to 25, that's clear and unambiguous, I think. But what happens next? You could understand what happens next in this way. At the end of verse 25, the Moabites are almost down and out. The Israelites have marched through their land and taken their cities. The Moabites are almost down and out, almost, but not quite. And in verses 26 and 27, then, they make two last-ditch attempts to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. The first attempt is military, and it fails, these 700 swordsmen in verse 26. The second attempt, however, is religious. The king's son killed as a burnt offering, and it succeeds. And the Israelites, on the brink of victory, are suddenly forced to retreat. So on this reading then, the battle ends in verse 27. It ends with Moab overturning what had looked like certain defeat. That's a common reading of this passage. That's the reading you'll find in most of the commentators. But we need to be clear. If it's correct, it means Elisha's prophecy did not come true. Israel didn't conquer Moab. That's what Elisha had foretold in verse 18, but it didn't happen. It almost happened, but an 11th hour revival on the part of the Moabites finally prevented the prophesied conquest. Now, if you're comfortable with Elisha's "Thus says the Lord" being in this instance nothing more than hot air, then feel free to go with that interpretation which I've just outlined. For my part, however, I prefer to understand the passage this way. After the Israelites have gone through the land of Moab, the Moabites make one last-ditch attempt. Not two last-ditch attempts, they make one last-ditch attempt. the 700 swordsmen there in verse 26. And when that fails, the game is up and Moab concedes defeat. That is to say, the battle ends in verse 26. In verse 26, Elisha's prophecy has come true and Israel has indeed conquered Moab. And with the battle over, the king of Moab then offers this sacrifice in verse 27, a sacrifice which I think we're meant to understand Israel participated in with the Moabites. What was the sacrifice about? Well, partly an acknowledgement by the king of Moab of his guilt in rebelling against the overlord, the Israelite king. An acknowledgement indeed of his own liability to the death which his son was experiencing in his place. Partly a weakening of Moab's royal house for the future. So notice we're explicitly told, aren't we, in verse 27, he took his oldest son who was to reign in his place, the narrator says. And it's almost a way then of the Moabites saying to Israel, look, we won't try this again. This rebellion business. We won't try this again. With our next king now dead, we won't be in a position to try this again. Partly that, I think, is the purpose. And then partly from Israel's perspective, remember I said just now they're participating here, from Israel's perspective, it's a celebration of their victory. It's a common phenomenon in the Old Testament that following a victory, a burnt offering takes place. So I'm saying the sacrifice isn't part of the battle. It's after the battle. But of course, the thing that none of you will have missed in the explanation that I've just given is this. Israel should not be participating in this. Human sacrifice is an abomination which Yahweh hates. Israel shouldn't be touching this sacrifice with a barge pole. And that's why then halfway through verse 27 we read, and there came great wrath against Israel. This is Yahweh's wrath. We don't know exactly what form it took. Was it perhaps a plague or something like that? But whatever it was, it forced Israel to withdraw from Moab. In other words, 2 Kings 3 isn't about God through Elisha promising Israel the conquest of Moab, but then Moab, in fact, proving too strong for Israel. No, rather, it's about God promising Israel the conquest of Moab and God bringing about the conquest of Moab, but Israel then forfeiting what had been promised by its own wickedness. That is what 2 Kings 3 is about. And I wonder, does that remind you of anything? Think of that generation of Israelites that experienced the Exodus. That generation was promised the conquest of Canaan. It never got the conquest of Canaan. Why not? Because the promise failed? No, because it forfeited what had been promised through its wickedness. Actually, there are several echoes in this passage of what happened to that Exodus generation. We have here a journey through a wilderness, don't we? That's certainly reminiscent. We have here a lack of water in the wilderness. Again, that rings bells, doesn't it? We have here the divine provision of water. We encountered that, of course, in our recent studies in the book of Exodus. And we have here the Israelites participating in an evil Moabite sacrifice. Look at the beginning of Numbers 25 and you'll find the very same thing there. Now, of course, the next generation of Israelites did experience the conquest of Canaan. You can read about that in the book of Joshua. But we're in 2 Kings now. We're in its early stages, and as some of you will know, we're racing towards two phenomenally dark moments that will come in a few chapters' time. First, in chapter 17, the northern tribes will lose their share of Canaan as the Assyrians conquer them. And then in chapter 25, the southern tribe of Judah will lose its share in Canaan as the Babylonians strike devastatingly. And at both of those moments then, it's not God's earlier promise of Canaan somehow going wrong. It's again a forfeiting of what had been promised through their wickedness. And this is what I mean then when I say this passage points us to a sad pattern. In a sense, what we have in 2 Kings 3 is the encapsulation in a single chapter of a huge Old Testament motif. The forfeiting by Israel here of this little promised land of Moab, promised to them in verse 18, which in the grand scheme of things isn't massively consequential because they don't really need Moab anyway. The forfeiting by Israel of this little promised land is a kind of miniature of Israel's recurring tendency to forfeit the promised land, the land of Canaan. Perhaps given, as I say, that we're racing towards 2 Kings 17 and 2 Kings 25. Perhaps this is intended, this whole episode, as a warning to King Jehoram and King Jehoshaphat. So that if these two kings have eyes to see it, the forfeiting of promised Moab will flash at them an enormous red light. Don't forfeit promised Canaan. Don't continue in wickedness and experience God's wrath coming against you, driving you out of that land, which otherwise could remain yours. Well, I'm not going to say anything by way of application at this point, but I hope that has given you an idea anyway of what is going on here and the way in which then this passage is a kind of enacted parable, if you like, of Israel's recurring problem, her sad pattern of forfeiting through wickedness the promised land. A sad pattern. But let's move on quickly to a second heading. A stunning peak. A stunning peak. And I mean peak, P-E-E-K. Not a mountain peak, but a brief glimpse. That kind of peak. So is this sad pattern that I've described in the last couple of minutes, is it just going to rumble on and on and on interminably? God's promise of a land now being claimed by his people, now being forfeited by his people. Are the two scenarios just going to continue kind of alternating aimlessly without any resolution, without any end? Is that what is going to happen? Well, you read some parts of the Old Testament and you might think so. But then you read other parts of the Old Testament and you sense that God has something else up his sleeve. You sense that the whole project of giving his people a land isn't the real thing, if I may put it like that. It isn't actually what he's about. It has points of contact with the real thing. It teaches important truths about the real thing. I'm not for one moment saying this whole land thing is just a pointless diversion, but it isn't the real thing. Because the real thing, the project God is actually working on, the purpose God actually has in view, it isn't giving his people a land someplace else. His purpose, rather, is to transform for them where they already are. To transform for them where they already are. Where in the Old Testament do you get a sense of that? Well, one of my favorite passages is Isaiah 35. Let me just read you a couple of bits of Isaiah 35. The chapter begins, "The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The deserts shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon." Or you go down to halfway through verse 6, "Waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, the thirsty ground springs of water in the haunt of jackals where they lie down. The grass shall become reeds and rushes." how should we interpret the wilderness there in Isaiah 35? It's clearly not talking about any specific geographically locatable wilderness in Israel or somewhere. How should we interpret it? Well, I think we're meant to understand it's this wilderness that we all inhabit. The world became a wilderness after the fall, after our forefather Adam ate the forbidden fruits. This world became a wilderness. And Isaiah 35, then, like some other passages in the Old Testament, is indicating that God is going to transform it for his people into a paradise. Let me mention something else. In some of these Old Testament passages that I have in mind, you also get the sense that a king is going to be involved in this transformation. It makes sense. A king, of course, was involved in this world becoming a wilderness in the first place, King Adam. And a king then is going to be involved in the world's transformation. I think you get that in Psalm 72 that we sang from just now. And as we said, Psalm 72 is all about a king. And there are some touches there similar to Isaiah 35, particularly what we sang, verse 16, may there be abundance of corn in the land, on the tops of the mountains may it wave. Fruit, may its fruit be like Lebanon. This idea of fruitfulness and abundance in unlikely places, even on the tops of hills where you don't normally get abundance and fruitfulness. So I'm saying then that there are these exciting passages suggesting that the God giving his people a land story with all its twists and turns, that isn't the real story. Rather, God involving somehow a king is going to transform the wilderness of this world into a paradise. And I will put it to you then that here in this very passage we're looking at, where we're pointed so depressingly, as we've seen, to the sad pattern, here in this very passage, suddenly and unexpectedly, we also get a stunning peek of this other, greater story. This business of God providing water. Verse 16, I will make this dry stream bed full of pools. And as it goes on, I mean, this is far more than God simply meeting the need of this army, isn't it? This is something extravagant. This is something extraordinary. The way in which we read in verse 20 that water came from the direction of Eden till the country, or land, literally, the land was filled with water. And indeed, the very fact that the Moabites could see all this redness, again, indicates we're not talking about a stream filling up in order to provide for the army. We're talking about suddenly this wilderness being transformed in rather a similar way to what we've read about just there in Isaiah 35. And a king is involved here, isn't he? Isn't it very striking the way in which Elisha begins in this encounter with the kings, and he says, what have I to do with you, addressing the king of Israel there in verse 13. And you sense his anger, don't you, with the king of Israel. That's, I think, why he calls for a musician, because he's so wound up, he needs to calm down. He's angry with this, with Jehoram. And he says then, in verse 14, as the Lord of hosts live before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you. It's only because of this king from the house of David who's present here that this transformation of the wilderness takes place. Jehoram stupidly, King Jehoram has taken them into the wilderness. Why has he suggested in the first place this ridiculous route, this circuitous march, as it's put in verse 9? He's like Adam. He's the one that takes them into the wilderness in the first place. And once there, rather like Adam, he blames God even, doesn't he? The Lord has called us here. This woman you gave me, she gave me the fruit to eat. But it's because of this Davidic king, this king from the house of David, that the wilderness is going to be transformed into paradise. And I'm saying then, in this somewhat grim and depressing episode, we're given suddenly this stunning peek, this little fleeting glimpse of what God is really doing, what God's ultimate purpose is. And I just want to pause there and ask you, do you know about this? Perhaps you think that the Bible is just full of irrelevant little stories about an ancient people constantly messing up. What's that got to do with the world that you and I live in? The world of COVID and climate change and people trafficking? Perhaps you're asking that. I want to say to you, the Bible confronts us, in fact, with this bold and radical proposition that God, through a king in David's line, through King Jesus, God is in the business of healing this broken world. And he invites all men and women and boys and girls to align themselves with this King Jesus, and in that way participate in the healing of this world. And I want to ask then, have you done that? Have you aligned yourself with King Jesus? Are you part of this tonight? You may go out of this room this evening rejecting the message of the Bible. I can't force you to accept it, but I do want you to go out of this room at least understanding what it is that you're rejecting. Not some trivial little notions about feeling warm and fuzzy with God in your life. That's not what the Bible's message is. Rather, it's this epic vision of a God, through the work of King Jesus, reclaiming his splendid creation for himself and making it one day a place of consummate beauty and glory and perfection and a home to all who have owned him as their God through King Jesus Christ. That's the Bible's message. That's what you're rejecting if you say no. Not silly religion, but this epic, bold vision of a God who's going to transform this wilderness of a world into paradise through King Jesus. So a sad pattern, a stunning peak. But then thirdly and finally this evening, a shared possibility. A shared possibility. So while enjoying then the stunning peak that we're given in those middle verses of our chapter, we do need, in the last analysis, I think, to adapt the mood of our sermon to the mood of this passage. And it's not a happy passage. It ends on a very solemn note, doesn't it? If our interpretation that I outlined earlier is correct. It ends on on any interpretation, but especially the one I outlined earlier. It ends on a very solemn note, this idea of God's people forfeiting what had been promised. And I want us then to end on a solemn and sober note of challenge this evening. And I want to say this, that the possibility then of forfeiting what God has promised, that applies not just to Israel in relation to their land, it applies also to those who are trusting in King Jesus and awaiting the transformation of the universe that I've talked about to you just now. That's what I mean by a shared possibility. This is a possibility in both of those stories, the little story and the big story. Those who are trusting in King Jesus, or who are professing to do so and look like they are doing so, they too can foolishly throw it all away, the way that Israel repeatedly throughout the Old Testament story threw what had been promised away, the way that here they threw Moab away. And if you think I'm being heretical and not very reformed in saying such things, then I encourage you to read Hebrews 3 and 4, where you remember the writer talks at great length about that Exodus generation that I mentioned earlier, forfeiting the rest that God had promised them in the land of Canaan. And do you remember how he concludes that discussion there in Hebrews 4, verse 11. He writes, "Let us therefore," writing to a New Testament, New Covenant audience, a Christian church, "let us therefore strive to enter that rest." Now talking about the great rest, the wilderness transformed into paradise through King Jesus. "Let us strive to enter that rest so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience," the same sort of disobedience as those old covenant Israelites. Similarly, in 1 Corinthians 9 and 10, Paul talks about those same Israelites. And in that connection, he describes his own determination in 1 Corinthians 9, 26, not to be disqualified. That's the strong verb he uses. His own determination, the lengths to which he goes in order not, like the Israelites, to be disqualified. That is to forfeit what God has promised. You see, on the last day, there will be many who, for a time in this life, professed faith in Jesus Christ and heard the promise of the world to come, the promise of the paradise ahead, and took hold of that promise for themselves, but who will nevertheless experience on that day God's wrath and exclusion. Why? Well, because in this life, subsequent to their profession of faith in Jesus Christ and their taking hold of the promise, subsequent to that, some sin, some rival affection to Jesus Christ hijacked their hearts and suffocated their discipleship. And I'm saying then, and I want to close saying to you tonight, don't be one of them. Don't be one of those there on that judgment day who once professed faith in Christ for a season, looked forward to paradise for a season, but on that day, you're the object of great wrath coming against you because you didn't profess faith in Jesus Christ and take hold of the promise of paradise right up to the very end. Don't be one of those people. You're here this evening, perhaps, cherishing the promise. Don't forfeit that promise before it ever transpires. Don't be disqualified, in Paul's language. And that means tomorrow morning, in the face of temptations, being vigilant. It doesn't happen overnight, this disqualification. The letter to the Hebrews talks of gradual processes, doesn't it? That drifting like a boat in chapter 2, being entangled gradually, chapter 12. It's a process. Beware that process that disqualifies a former professor in Jesus Christ, a former holder of the promise, so that ultimately they forfeit what had been promised. This morning, we were looking at a text that was so encouraging. And there are many parts of the Bible like that that assure us Jesus will do his work in us. And some of you need that tonight, I know. And I throw you back onto this morning's sermon in that case. You're feeling anxious that you're not going to finish the course and you need that reassurance that Jesus will do everything and finish what he has begun. Some of you need that, but perhaps others of you don't need that so much. You're complacent. You're messing around. You're playing with fire. You need to hear Hebrews 3 and 4. You need to hear 1 Corinthians 9 and 10. You need to look at the Israelites here, forfeiting what God had promised. And you need to hear that you can do the same if you carry on being complacent and foolish. Don't be disqualified. Keep running. Make sure that you endure to the end and enjoy that paradise that God has promised to all who endure to the end. Amen.